This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Well, this morning a challenge. Can David Elliard summarise the whole of the history of science in a quarter of an hour? He's just written a book about it. So, David, away you go.
When did science, as we know it today, begin? Was it way back in ancient Greece, with the earliest natural philosophers, Thales, Democritus, Plato, and the towering Aristotle? Was it in China, home to so many advances in technology? Gunpowder, rockets, the compass, paper, printing, invented more than 1,000 years ago? Was it in the Middle East, where the flame of ancient learning was kept alight and even fanned by Islamic scholars and researchers when Europe was dark, awaiting the Renaissance? In my new book, Who Discovered What When?, I place those origins in Italy in the early 16th century. From there and then, we can trace a steady and ever-growing stream of discoveries about the workings of the natural world, unbroken to the present day. Certainly, there were wellsprings further back, but many had run dry. Both in China and Arabia, the spirit of free inquiry, the essential nutrient of science, had been crushed by centralised bureaucratic governments. Here and there, enlightened minds were already challenging the orthodox views about man and nature, first formulated by the Greeks and sanctified by the Church. Many of these troublesome spirits were in fact monks, since the Church was the repository of such learning as there was at the time. The English Franciscan monk Roger Bacon in the 13th century knew the value of observation and experiment as paths to reliable and useful knowledge. For example, his understanding of the behaviour of lenses contributed to the invention of spectacles soon after. But he wanted science taught in the universities, and as a result had considerable trouble with the ecclesiastical authorities. Bacon's contemporary, William of Ockham, who taught in Oxford and Paris, devised his famous principle of simplicity in scientific explanations, from which this programme gets its name. A century later, Nicholas of Cusa was a cardinal, but also a student of astronomy, who taught the then heretical idea that the Earth went round the sun and not the reverse. He also noted that plants, as they grew, seemed to take in something from the air, a dim early glimpse of the phenomenon of photosynthesis. But these were isolated sparks in the gloom. Conventional wisdom, backed by the Church, declared that the writings of the ancient Greek sages, Ptolemy in astronomy and geography, Galen in medicine, Aristotle in just about everything, held all that was correct and necessary in understanding nature and our place in it. And while the direct hold of the Church over new ideas was to weaken, especially after Galileo, who refuted so much of Aristotle's science, Bible stories and theological concepts continue to influence and even impede the development of scientific ideas well into the 19th century. Around 1500, these challenges to antique wisdom began to pick up speed and take clearer form, particularly in what we now call Italy. The reasons for this are much debated. The fall of Constantinople to the Ottoman Turks a few decades earlier had brought into the jostling principalities and dukedoms of the Italian peninsula many scholars, fleeing the catastrophe and bringing with them new ideas and ancient manuscripts. There they found sanctuary and patronage. Some see a major influence from the great age of exploration, which had just begun with the exploits of Vasco da Gama, Christopher Columbus, and many others. In lands unknown to Ptolemy, explorers found plants and animals unknown to Aristotle. The reputations of those sages began to fray. Undoubtedly, the mastery of printing with movable type by Gutenberg and others late in the 15th century allowed new and even heretical ideas, like those of Copernicus, to spread rapidly. There was, I suggest, another crucial influence, the growth of dissent within the Church, with strengthening opposition to established practices and beliefs. The key date here is, of course, 1517, when Martin Luther's hammer on the door of Wittenberg Cathedral formally inaugurated the Reformation. But undercurrents of dissent had been flowing for decades. We can see the influence of the Reformation by mapping where science became most vigorous in the century or two that followed. Italy was active early on, with Camillus, da Vinci, Fracastoro, and travellers like the Flemish anatomist Vesalius and the Polish astronomer Copernicus, who worked or studied there. But a century later, the manner in which the Church sought to crush Galileo made science, especially astronomy, seem a dangerous occupation, and discoveries began to dry up. In the 17th century, Marcello Malfigi was a master in the use of the new microscope, but that did not prevent his laboratory being sacked and burned and his instruments destroyed by a mob opposed to his supposedly heretical ideas. In Catholic Spain, suppression of new ideas was an industry, so although Spain was the richest and most powerful nation in Europe at the time, it made no significant contributions to science. There is, in fact, not a single entry from Spain in the 400 in my book. The Spaniard Michael Servetus knew more about the circulation of the blood than anyone until William Harvey, but he went to the stake as a heretic nonetheless. France, which remained mostly within the Catholic fold after the Reformation, was likewise mostly barren in science until Louis XIV decided that excellence in research and technology, like military victory, was a pathway to national greatness, and began to patronise science and scientists. But in the lands north of the Rhine, the Low Countries, Scandinavia, northern Germany, together with England and Scotland, the Reformation took root. These may have been poor nations compared with the glories of Italy, Spain and France, but science flourished there in an atmosphere where much more was open to question in politics, religion, philosophy. In the later 17th century, the prominent names were often Dutch or Flemish, like the astronomer and mathematician Christian Huygens, Willibrord Snell, who expounded the law of refraction of light, the early chemist Jan van Helmont, and the pioneering microscopists Antony van Leeuwenhoek and Jan Swammerdam. Or they were German, the astronomer Johannes Kepler, and Otto von Guericke, who experimented with air pressure and electricity. Or Danish, like Ole Rømer, who first measured the speed of light. And across the channel, there was a flood of discoveries, from natural philosophers so numerous I can do little more than mention their names. Robert Boyle, Robert Hooke, John Ray, Nicholas Grew, Edmund Halley, John Mayo, Christopher Wren, and of course, Isaac Newton. From Italy, Francesco Grimaldi, whose ideas on light inspired Newton. Little remembered nowadays, Grimaldi is an interesting case study because he was a Jesuit. There's some irony here, since the Jesuits were the standard bearers of the Counter-Reformation, set up by Rome to oppose the new religious ideas. But a number of Jesuits turned to science, pioneering the view that a man of faith could also be a man of science. Indeed, by the 18th century, natural philosophers like the Englishman Stephen Hales, a pioneer in chemistry and biophysics, strongly believed that studying the natural world was a most appropriate task for a man of faith, since nature was the handiwork of the Creator. So began a rapprochement, not always an easy one, between science and religion, which was to last until the time of Charles Darwin. The fact that Stephen Hales was a clergyman, and certainly not the only one active in science at the time, helps illuminate another significant issue. Why there's so few women in science, and almost none until modern times. Even natural philosophers had to eat, and so they needed a source of income. The church was a good fit here. Men of the cloth often had time on their hands, and they had that passion to understand nature. Women could not be priests or parsons at that time. Nor could they be doctors, as many early researchers were. Take William Gilbert, physician to Elizabeth I and student of the Earth's magnetism. Or trained in the law, the great French chemist Antoine Lavoisier, for example. Or lecturers in the universities, like Isaac Newton. They could not usually have private means, which enabled a number of men, such as the Irish aristocrat Robert Boyle, and later, of course, Charles Darwin, to be active in science without concern for making a living. So women are historically scarce in science. In my book, the first woman mentioned is Caroline Herschel, in the context of being sister and assistant to William Herschel, the late 18th century English astronomer. She helped him in both music and astronomy, though she made many important discoveries herself. The first woman with an entry of her own is the pioneering paleontologist Mary Anning, but she was an ill-educated child of 12 when she first made a significant fossil find in 1811. At the end of the 19th century, we come, of course, to the Titanic Marie Curie, who changed the landscape completely. She took over the professorship at the Sorbonne, previously held by her husband Pierre, tragically killed in a street accident, and was the first woman to hold a chair in France and probably anywhere. Despite this, and two Nobel Prizes, she was never elected to the French Academy of Science. Male prejudice ran deep. By the early to mid-20th century, the career, the profession of a scientist, was firmly established. The number of paid jobs was growing as both government and industry took more interest. The pathway into science through education was clearer, and women became more prominent. I see this process continuing. It may well be that in the 21st century, more than half the active researchers will be women. One of the lessons to come from any study of the history of scientific ideas is that science is cumulative. Very few scientific ideas, if any, come from nothing. Even the greatest scientific minds, Galileo, Lavoisier, Faraday, Curie, Darwin, Einstein, drew inspiration and ideas from others, adding value in the process. Not all ideas take root immediately. Some must be discovered again and again before being accepted. The germ theory of disease, usually attributed to the 19th century Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch, was expounded at least twice before their time. Pasteur could cite evidence that the early researchers did not have and was able to convince his contemporaries, but he did not invent the idea or even the word germ. Many other ideas founded, at least temporarily, on the rocks of prejudice because they did not satisfy the orthodoxy of the time, especially when that orthodoxy was linked to a powerful influence like Isaac Newton. Such opinion leaders held such sway that what later proved to be valid and well-supported theories were consigned to limbo, sometimes for half a century. Avogadro's famous hypothesis is one such. There are examples on the other side as well, ideas later shown to be quite inadequate or misleading, but which enjoyed popular support, often for decades. Physicists mused for centuries on the contradictory properties of the exceedingly tenuous ether they visualised filling all space, before finding it could not be detected, and so did not, in any useful sense, exist. The enduring appeal of such erroneous ideas is a fascinating subject for study. But these ideas, like all science, must ultimately stand and fall on the basis of evidence gathered by observation and experiment. I have been asked many times to name what I think is the most important discovery discussed in my book. While it may seem to dodge the question, I usually answer with one not explicitly listed. I think the most important discovery of all, the one that underpins all the rest, was how to do science. What distinguishes the last 500 years from what went on before is an ever more insistent and methodical reliance on evidence, experiment, observation, and meticulous recording as the path to reliable knowledge and better understanding, rather than deductions from ancient writings. Many people before 1500, including Aristotle himself, knew you had to look at the real world with open eyes to comprehend it. But that fundamental lesson had mostly been forgotten. Once it was recovered and became widely accepted, science could begin.
And it's been transforming the world ever since. David Elliard, whose book Who Discovered What When is a trove of the unexpected. Next week at this time, Sue Taylor on Why You Should Watch Birds. I'm Robin Williams.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.